The way I would put it is I did something that was stupid and wrong, and that it was more than just a mistake. It was, in my judgment, a sin.
The historian Joseph J. Ellis lied about his past a few years ago. He told bogus stories about his service in the Vietnam War, and he was caught.
And the only thing you can do with a sin is face it, confess it, do penance, and then, after a decent interval, ask for forgiveness.
His scholarship was not called into question, and Joseph Ellis remains one of the best-known writers about the Founding Fathers. Now he's finished a biography of George Washington called His Excellency.
This is the president who supposedly said, "I cannot tell a lie." Joseph Ellis points out that story is a lie. It was invented by a biographer after Washington led the American Revolution and became the first American president. Ellis goes on to say that the real George Washington carefully managed his public image. He first became famous after two military defeats. Washington was involved in disastrous campaigns in the 1750s at the start of the French and Indian War. But what people remembered was that Washington stayed calm as men were killed all around him.
He's got four bullet holes through his coat, got one through his hat, three horses shot out from under him, and he's never scratched. And that's the beginning of the story that you start to see in newspapers and of the time. This is a man of destiny.
This is Washington as a young man that you're describing.
Yes. I really think it's important we be able to picture him as a young man. All of the mental images we have of Washington derive from his portraits done late in his life, usually the ones by Gilbert Stuart, the one on the dollar bill, for example. As a young man, he is a physical specimen. He's a head taller than anybody else of his time. He's a natural athlete, the best rider. I sort of think of him like John Wayne circa 1939 in Stagecoach. And he created space around himself that nobody was supposed to enter. And there's a famous story that's probably apocryphal. At a cocktail hour during the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787, Alexander Hamilton challenges Gouverneur Morris, another delegate, to go up to Washington, put his hand on his shoulder and say, "How you doing, George?" And Morris actually does it, and Washington lifts his hand off of the shoulder and stares at this guy in a kind of "how dare you" fashion. He's not very self-revealing in his diary. It's wonderful to compare, say, John Adams' diary, which tells you not only what he's thinking, but what he's feeling. Washington's diary tells you about the weather and which way the wind is blowing, and he's not being metaphorical. On the last day of his public life, the day he steps down from the presidency and turns it over to John Adams, March 6, 1797, you look at his diary, it says, "A day like all days, temperature 41 degrees.
Was Washington writing the diary like that because he sensed that somebody like you would be reading it a couple hundred years later?
I think there's some truth in that. I think that at a certain stage in his life, by the time of the American Revolution and the end of the Revolution, I think that virtually everything that Washington wrote was written with an eye towards posterity.
What did you find when you dug into his personal life, his intimate life as a young man?
That he is an extraordinarily ambitious person. He's a creature of power. Jefferson is the rhetorician of freedom and liberty. Washington is a more dangerous figure, but in the end, a figure who knows how to control power and to surrender it. He's a real aficionado of exits. And if you think about it, most of the other major revolutionary heroes in subsequent revolutions like the French, Russian, and Chinese end up consolidating power and becoming the despotic leader. Washington does just the opposite.
What motivated George Washington as a Virginia planter to decide that he should join and, in fact, lead the revolution?
If you think about the coming of the American Revolution, you usually start thinking about arguments against British taxation and Parliament's power over the colonies. But for him, the reasons to join the resistance movement against Britain were more palpable. One was that he owned about 40,000 acres of land out there beyond the Alleghenies, which the British were going to take away from him. There's also a certain degree of resentment of a British sense of superiority. Washington, when he applies to become a British officer in the 1750s and is rejected, does not take that as a sign that he's unworthy. He takes it as a sign that the British are stupid. And then finally, I think that as a planter in Virginia, he's come to the conclusion by the late 1760s that the way the empire works, it makes it almost impossible for him to break even. He's in debt, and he feels that there's a kind of conspiracy over there between British politicians and merchants.
So is it accurate to say that Washington's story of taking control of the Continental Army during the Revolution and then going on to become President of the United States, it's not a story necessarily of idealism, it's a story of, I don't know, enlightened self-interest, perhaps?
Yes, and he's got a very realistic sense of what he's up against. He's not participating in the kind of glorification of the American cause. He realizes the British Army is almost unbeatable, but he knows that he has to do it.
You're publishing this book in the midst of a presidential campaign.
That is correct.
What of Washington's wisdom, if any, is applicable to the partisan divisions in this country today?
I think that Washington would find that reprehensible. He really believed that the president should levitate above all partisan arguments and think and act only for the public.
Although it's interesting, it's easy when you hear that to side with Washington's point of view on this. But I wonder if, in a way, the way the country has changed is not so bad. It's a more democratic society. The reason that Washington was able to levitate above everybody else was because he was a member of the aristocracy from the biggest, most powerful state, and it really wasn't all that democratic a country.
No, it wasn't. And the word Democrat was an epithet in the 18th century. They didn't think they were creating a democracy. The positive way to put it is they created a set of republican institutions that have stood the test of time and that permit the evolution of America towards a much more democratic society in the 19th and in the 20th century. But that, what I guess I'm saying is that with democracy comes consequences that make it very difficult to recreate the kind of political leadership that we had back there at the start.
Joseph J. Ellis is the author of His Excellency, A Biography of George Washington. Mr. Ellis, it's been fun talking to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve. My pleasure.